The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is called Favorite Poets. I am Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Robert Pinsky, Poet Laureate of the United States. He's going to say hello with an opening poem, a new poem.
Samurai Song. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. When I had no supper, my eyes dined. When I had no eyes, I listened. When I had no ears, I thought. When I had no thought, I waited. When I had no father, I made care my father. When I had no mother, I embraced order. When I had no friend, I made quiet my friend. When I had no enemy, I opposed my body. When I had no temple, I made my voice my temple. I have no priest. My tongue is my choir. When I have no means, fortune is my means. When I have nothing, death will be my fortune. Need is my tactic. Detachment is my strategy. When I had no lover, I courted my sleep.
A gorgeous new poem by Robert Pinsky. Was that in The New Yorker?
Yes, it was, Grace.
Yes. And what is the title of this manuscript?
It's a book that will come out in April of 2000, and the title is Jersey Rain.
Robert Pinsky is the award-winning translator of The Inferno of Dante. He is a professor at Boston University in the graduate program. He now serves an unprecedented third term as Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry at the Library of Congress. Your legacy here is the Favorite Poem Project, and we might as well tell everybody what it is.
The goal of the Favorite Poem Project is first to make an audio and video archive of about 1,000 Americans of all kinds, every region of the country, every state, every possible age, ethnicity, profession, with each person saying aloud a poem that person loves and a few sentences about why that particular poem is important to that person. I hope that the 20,000 letters I've received from people volunteering for that archive will also be an important document and a useful archive. And I hope that the videos and audios themselves will become valuable teaching tools as well as a kind of historical gift to the future. It's a little snapshot of the United States in the year 2000 through the lens of poetry.
How can people plug into this information right now?
If you go to favoritepoem.org, at favoritepoem.org, we have many more poems than we used to. There's the text of quite a few poems and letters from the welders and librarians and teachers and circus acrobats who chose them. And under the story, you can hear me and see me describe what the project is. And under the readings, you can find about readings at various cities around the country where we had unemployed people and U.S. senators and mayors and laborers read poems together. You also, I guess, can buy the book, the just out from Norton, Americans' Favorite Poems.
Wonderful. Robert Pinsky is the author of 5+ books of poetry, Sadness and Happiness, An Explanation of America, History of My Heart, The Want Bone, The Figured Wheel, New and Collected Poems, and now these other poems forthcoming. And he is one of the best known poets who ever lived, actually, because he lived in a time where the voice was able to be taken from here to there by microwave and underground cable. Instead of disdaining this, he has entered the world and the dailiness of it and changed it all to poetry. And we will thank you for many years to come. But in your own right, you are first and always a distinguished poet. So may we have another poem?
Sure. How about a bit longer one, also from Jersey Rain, from the new book? Is that okay?
That'd be great. It's a premiere.
This poem is called The Green Piano. The Green Piano. Aeolian. Gratis. Great Thunderer. half-ton infant of miracles torn free of charge from the universe by my mother's will. You must have amazed that half-respectable street of triple-decker families and rooming house house painters the day that the bowl-ankled, oversized hams of your legs bobbed in procession up the crazy paved front walk embraced by the arms of Mr. Popick, the seltzer man, and Corridon, his black-skinned helper, tendering your thighs thick as a man up our steps. We are not reptiles. Even the male body bears nipples, as if to remind us we are designed for dependence and nutriment, past into future. Oh, Europe, they budged your case, its ponderous guts of iron and brass, 10 kinds of hardwood and felt, up those heel-pocked risers and treads splintering tinder. Angelic nurse of clamor, yearner, tinkler, dominator, oh, elephant, you were for me. When the tuner, Mr. Otto van Brunt, pronounced you excellent, despite the cracked sounding board, we obeyed him and swabbed your ivories with hydrogen peroxide. You blocked a doorway and filled most of the living room. The sofa and chairs dwindled to a ram and ewes, cowering. Now the colored neighbors could be positive we were crazy and rich, as we thought the people were who gave you away for the moving out of their carriage house. They had painted you the color of pea soup. The drunk man my mother hired never finished antiquing you ivory and umber, so you stood half done, a throbbing, mistreated noble, genuine, my mother's swollen livestock of love, lost one. Unmastered. You were the beast she led to the shrine of my genius, mistaken. Endlessly I bonged according to my own chord system, humoresque, the talk of the town, what I say. Then, one day, they painted you pink. Pink is how my sister remembers you, the Saturday afternoon our mother fell on her head, dusty pink as I turn on the bench in my sister's memory, to see them carrying our mother up the last steps and into the living room, inaugurating the reign of our confusion. They sued the builder of the house she fell in. With the settlement, they bought a house at last, and one day, when I came home from college, you were gone, O mahogany breast, who nursed me through those years of the concussion, and there was a crappy little Baldwin acrosonic in your place, gleaming. Walnut shell, you were gone, despoiled one, pink one, forever green one, white and gold one, comforter, a living soul.
That poem was published someplace. Was that in the New Yorker?
Yes, it was.
Oh, yes, because I know I could not have remembered it from a former reading because of the intricacies of it. And you are an American historian who brings us American culture in details, in broken pieces of windows, in little knobs in green pianos. And this will be, I guess, something that we will say no one else has done quite like this.
Well, you're too nice, Grace. You're too kind. But I'll admit I'm pleased to have gotten the words crappy little Baldwin acrosonic into a poem.
Many have tried. Robert Pinsky, he's the poet laureate of the United States. He's our poet. And I'm going to ask you some things that you have said too many times, but not perhaps to this audience. And we may be having people that are meeting you for the first time. So I need to share with them the thing that you are so famous for, and that is, we will call it the musical celebration of air, where you talk about poetry as a bodily art. And this is something which may be new to the ears out there, and some people had not heard this. So if you would just tell us your theory on poetry as sound.
The poetry I love, poetry as I understand it, has a peculiarly intimate and widely available power, because the medium of a poem, in my understanding of the art, is not words. The medium of the poem is the audience's body. It is a vocal art, but not necessarily a performative art. So though the medium of the poem is breath, it's air, that is the medium, the thing between the feelings and ideas of the poet and the reader, is the reader's breath, your voice or my voice saying Emily Dickinson's words or Yeats's words, it's not necessarily Emily Dickinson or Yeats performing their poem or a trained and wonderful actor performing the poem. It's whoever wants to say the poem. And that seems to me to be primary, and it does give poetry a particularly intimate and personal place, but it also means the art is inherently on a human scale. It is by its nature on the scale of one person.
Many must have felt this before you made it a public statement and before you made it a creed, but I think you've jogged some memories big time since you have vocalized this and articulated your thoughts. John Hollander's book, Committed to Memory, which just came out in 96, I feel was very much influenced by you. And the poems he chose, 100 poems, which people could read aloud, I doubt would have happened otherwise.
Well, I think John and I are thinking alike, and perhaps we're responding to something in our time. Perhaps many people are responding to it. You know, the sales of books of poems are way up. Poetry is kind of booming. And I sometimes think that is in reaction, as John and I are, to the quite wonderful mass media, that the electronic media are very pleasurable, very elegant, beautiful, but inherently, by their nature, on a mass scale. The electronic work is, by its nature and inherently, highly duplicable very rapidly. And the medium is a duplicated medium. And maybe that has stimulated us to remember that very basic and primary pleasure that any child takes in the sounds of language.
I thought of you when I read Elizabeth Bishop's sonnet, "There is a magic made of melody."
Oh,
and
yes.
Another line, "Of some song sung to rest the tired dead." And you who celebrate the dead every day of your life by committing yourself to what has been said by saying it again is something seriously to think about at this time in life when we can, as you say, multiply our voice so many places to so many millions of people.
Yes, and we're multiplying the voices of the dead, of Elizabeth Bishop, of Ben Jonson, not through electronic means, but in our own bodies when we say the words of one of their poems aloud and take pleasure in it.
So that's why we're going to ask you to say the poem aloud right now to us. One of yours, please. This is from The Figured Wheel, which is a collected volume. And it was the one, I guess the last one published.
Yes, the most recent one until this spring. From City Elegies, The Daydreamers. The Daydreamers. All day, all over the city, every person wanders a different city, sealed, intact, and haunted as the abandoned subway stations under the city. Where is my alley doorway? Stone gable, brick escarpment, cliffs of crystal. Where is my terraced street above the harbor, cafe and hidden workshop, house of love, webbed vault, tiled blackness? Where is my park, the path through conifers, my iron bench, a shiver of ivy and margin birch above the traffic? A voice. There is a mountain and a wood between us, one wrote, lovesick, where the late hunter and the bird have seen us, aimless at dusk, heart muttering like any derelict, or working all morning, violent with will. Where is my garland of lights, my silver rail?
Here it is. Those last lines are just great. Did you like them when you wrote them?
Thank you.
Those are beautiful lines.
Thank you, Chris.
And I chose that poem because it tells who you are. You take the ordinary and you turn it to a garland. The everyday activity, there is nothing that you will not use in a poem. You preserve the ordinary, and it is, I guess, something William Carlos Williams actually did very well, too. In fact, did you just win an award, a William Carlos Williams award?
I did. did a couple of years ago.
Rightly
so. And it was
so.
A great pleasure for me to win an award with that name.
How just.
He certainly is an important, very important model for me, as well as a fellow citizen and resident of New Jersey.
And I'm from Trenton, you know.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
Caring, the caring that you can put into cement. We could probably get you to be quite an advertiser in the business. You put so much care and love and wisdom in the little, as I say, the knob on the end of the banister. Let's go on to another poem.
The Night Game.
Mm.
Some of us believe we would have conceived romantic love out of our own passions, with no precedence, without songs and poetry, or have invented poetry and music as a comb of cells for the honey. Shaped by ignorance, a succession of new worlds, congruities improvised by immigrants or children. I once thought most people were Italian, Jewish, or colored. To be white and called something like Ed Ford seemed aristocratic, a rare distinction. Possibly, I believed only Gentiles and blondes could be left-handed. Already famous after 1 year in the majors, Whitey Ford was drafted by the Army to play ball in the flannels of the Signal Corps, stationed in Long Branch, New Jersey. A night game. The silver potion of the lights, his pink skin shining like a burn. Never a player I liked or hated, a Yankee, a mere success. But white the chalked off lines in the grass, white and green the immaculate uniform, and white the unpigmented halo of his hair when he shifted his cap. So ordinary and distinct, so close up, that I felt as if I could have made him up, imagined him, as I imagined the ball, a scintilla high in the black backdrop of the sky. Tight red stitches, Rawlings, the bleached horsehide white, the color of nothing, color of the past and of the future, of the movie screen at rest and of blank paper. I could have, the mind, the black backdrop, the white fly picked out by the towering lights. A few years later, on a blanket in the grass by the same river, a girl and I came into being together to the faint muttering of unthinkable troubadours and radios. The Emerald Theater, the night. Another time, I devised a left-hander even more gifted than Whitey Ford, a Dodger. People were amazed by him. Once, when he was young, he refused to pitch on Yom Kippur.
Here's the riddle. When is a narrative a meditation?
I've always had trouble drawing an easy line amongst narrative and meditation and discourse. The poems I love, if I think of Yeats's Adam's Curse, it's a conversation, it's a meditation, it's a love poem, it tells a story and it meditates.
But the answer to the riddle is when Robert Pinsky writes it. That's when a meditation is a narrative. It is said by one critic, the figured wheel, new and collected poems, allows us to recognize the most scrupulously intelligent body of work produced by an American poet in the past 25 years. Kind of nice words. I have called you a public poet, and you use media to as the structure to transmit the human spirit. There is a price to pay for this, because you have to be on several continents at one time. And I wonder about the life, I'm sure just because of a high level of gossip interest, how you manage to, what is your schedule like? How many times do you tape? Do you have enough suits? You know, all of those things.
Yeah.
First of all, it looks real comfortable. You may wind up hosting The Price is Right or something. It looks really easy for you.
I think that my preparation for television and for traveling around the country and talking a lot, actually, it sounds like I'm just being wise guy, but I think that being a poor student in school was good preparation for that. I so often didn't have my homework done that it was a constant process of improvisation and not planning ahead, doing everything a little bit after the last minute. And that training myself to hope for the pop quiz and not the thing that wanted to see if you'd prepared well, I think that has helped me relax when I do things that still amaze me, like reading Wallace Stevens or Elizabeth Bishop or Ben Jonson on television. I do it because I don't have any better sense. You know, I never plan these things.
How do you choose the topic of the day?
Oh, I have good friends who help me and an excellent producer at the NewsHour, Jeff Brown, and we put our heads together and think about tomorrow. I think we're going to tape something for Veterans Day. We had already done Yusuf Komunyakaa's wonderful poem, Facing It. We had done David Ferry's The Soldier. And Jeff and I talked, and he was going through his anthology. I actually didn't have mine in front of me. And he mentioned Henry Reed. And I said, oh, yes, Naming of Parts. I think we're going to do that tomorrow. Sometimes I'll call up a friend. Certain people I ask, and I'll say, what do you think would be appropriate for Thanksgiving?
So you tie it to an event.
Yes, and sometimes we don't get together to tape before the event. There'll be a judgment in the Microsoft trial or something else will happen. I'll think I'll have a bright idea. And the timing isn't quite right. I was really delighted when the stock market took a dip. There is a great poem, or certainly a very, very wonderful poem that has the word stock exchange in it. And I got to read it on television.
I liked your debate with Roger Rosenblatt. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I did. Roger quoted Tennyson, and I quoted Yeats, and we were talking about the Yankees and the Dodgers.
It was a duel.
And I think the absurdity of it was certainly was fun for me, I think for Roger, too. And people do seem to have enjoyed that little thing.
I was going to say, do you get responses so that you know what goes over?
Yes. I would say the NewsHour there, it's about 95% very encouraging, very approving, and a very amusing 5% that says, what's this guy doing on television? I want the news. I don't want poetry on the news. I want the news.
And do you think you might go on after your term as laureate? It was nice that Robert Haas stayed with the Washington Post, and that's a great contribution.
It's a wonderful column. Oh. That Poet's Choice column that Bob does for the Post, syndicated in other papers too, is a great thing. I think it would probably be similar. I assume that I'll probably go on doing it for a while.
I'm going to tell you a few things he's won. His Figured Wheel, which we mentioned, was nominated for the Pulitzer and received the Ambassador Book Award of the English-Speaking Union. His book-length poem, An Explanation of America, was awarded the Saxifrage Prize when it was first published and is republished by Princeton University Press. History of My Heart is the one which was awarded William Carlos Williams Prize, and his collection of essays, Poetry in the World, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism. His previous book, The Inferno of Dante, was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it was awarded the Los Angeles Times Book Award in Poetry and the Howard Morton Landon Prize for Translation. We'll save some of the others for later. You have lots of pages here. You have been so busy. If you don't stop, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. I have too much information on you.
Yeah.
And still in love with media and poetry. I remember when you were poetry editor of The New Republic and for about 7 years, and now you are poetry editor for Slate, an
yes.
internet magazine. Now, that's another question I have about how that works technically. Carol Muskie told me that she gave you a poem for Slate. So I said, oh, how did you do that? She said, I sat in a studio and read into a microphone. And I said, what happened to it then? She said, I don't know. How does this work?
Well, Slate's publisher is Microsoft,
right.
a company you might have heard of that has a lot of technological capacity. And they take the recording of the poem and digitalize it. And they post it. It used to be in a real audio format. I notice now it's in a Windows player format of some kind. And anybody with the sound card and the right software, some speakers, clicks on the poem and they hear the poet read it aloud. Sometimes you do poems by dead poets and then you hear me read it aloud.
Yeah.
So the reader of Slate sees the text and also can hear the poet read the poem. And a nice thing about it is that it is all archived. It's all there. So at Slate, it's not only the poem of this week. You can go to the you can click on the archives and hear. The first one we did was the first issue with Seamus Heaney gave me a poem, and you can hear it's now a few years worth of poems.
Is space infinite?
In the world of digital storage, many things go wrong. It's an ephemeral form of storage, but space is not a big worry. So they can pile all those poems up.
And you understand it. You gave a talk on digital technology.
Oh,
did you memorize that the night before?
Really?
Well, I saw you interviewed on the internet. I guess it could have been Slate. Was it Ceylon? Maybe Ceylon? You just had an interview where people asked you questions and you answered them. And I read that and I thought, how did this happen?
I've done several, actually many live online interviews. The most recent one was for Barnes & Noble.
That's what I saw, actually.
The most recent one was for Barnes & Noble. And people at their computers log onto the site. They sent in questions. Questions appeared on my computer
screen. They were
smart
questions, too.
And I answered them. Oh, it was wonderful. I like that format very much.
It was good.
I like the challenge of typing an answer very quickly in a very short space.
You like anything difficult. I wrote an article about you called The Love of the Difficult.
You admitted that. Human beings do like difficulty. I think we all like it a lot.
Just not all of us. This is Robert Pinsky, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress celebrating the bicentennial in the most wonderful place in the world for books and for recorded poets. Robert Pinsky received the Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America, and he's also won awards from the Guggenheim, the NEA, the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I guess your work has appeared everywhere. We know the biggies, the New Yorker, Paris Review, the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry, Best Poems 90, 91, 92. They better keep going. They know it's good for them. Or we won't put them on the website. So we have him here for a moment. And when you're with him for a moment, you would never know he had anywhere to go, which I think is the greatest thing I can say about how easy it must be for you to calm down in a hurry. You pretend as if you've been nowhere else. You pretend as if you have nowhere else to go. And I do thank you for that.
Grace Cavalieri, you're the world's nicest person.
I noticed. We won't edit that out. We are now going to hear another poem from Robert Pinsky, a new poem.
This poem has 26 words in it, and they're arranged in alphabetical order. It also has punctuation, including an equal sign. When I come to the equal sign, I'll say it aloud. The poem is called ABC. ABC. Anybody can die, evidently. Few go happily, irradiating joy. Knowledge, love. Many need oblivion, painkillers, quickest respite. Sweet time unafflicted, various world. X equals your zenith.
I saw you said something about that somewhere. Where was it published?
It was published in the New York Review of Books.
And you remarked, what was the challenge that made you do this?
It's having the 26 words of the poem correspond exactly to the 26 letters of the alphabet.
Don't you have enough to do?
And no prepositions or articles allowed. and this thing of difficulty, I think it's pretty much universal. It's why the video parlors are full of kids putting quarters in the machines. It's why there are people out in golf courses with little sticks knocking white balls around. It's why people do knitting and ambitious gardening and cooking and build boats in their basement. It is a normal proclivity of the human animal to like to engage difficulty and cope with it.
If that were so, then all young people would be good students, though.
They are all good students, not necessarily in school or the subjects studied in school. They are students of fashion or of sports or of evil, alas, or of street fighting or of music of some kind. But I think young people are studying many things all the time. And the problem with school is to have them study the things that we think will enrich them and will let them enrich the world.
You said as a young person that you would look around and think, I'll never be able to do all this. Look at all those machines making all those things that make all those buildings. Who's going to take over when these people
it
die?
It still seems amazing to me that we do pass these things on from generation to generation.
And yet you managed to play the sax and
after fashion,
a few other things, and you still do play it. And you did say that you approached Dante with this ferocious love for the difficult.
That was a beautiful challenge, trying to make a readable, rapid, clear inferno in a version of Terza Rima was, once I knew that I could deal with that challenge, it was one of the best feelings I've ever had.
Ever?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was so much like writing. It was writing, except you didn't have to think of what to say next. The greatest poet who ever lived had already figured out what to say next.
Like my child said when she read Edna St. Vincent Millay, she said, Mommy, why don't you write that poem? You said you took one canto and that they were distributed from the publisher to several poets, and you did one, and then another poet could not do another one, so you picked up his.
Yes.
And then you did three. You said, well, I'm 10th of the way through. What a way to look at it. Couldn't stop.
Yeah, after I finished those two, I did one just because I liked doing it. Just the way you would do a crossword puzzle or turn on the radio or go outside and hit a tennis ball. I just felt like doing it. And I was about a tenth of the way into the project before it occurred to me to do it all. Sounds strange, but it really is true. I thought, well, maybe I'll do a few cantos.
And you said you did it as if you were a metrical engineer.
That was my contribution.
Are you mathematical, basically?
When I was a kid, I used to do quite well in objective math tests, and I used to enjoy math. But when you don't do any homework, you quickly fall by the wayside in math.
But you know what? You turned out okay. You have a steady job, a roof over your head, and enough to eat. So I think you made out okay.
Knock wood, Grace.
Robert Pinsky, poet laureate of the United States. He is America's poet. And I am Grace Cavalieri. It is a deep pleasure to be sitting across the table, and especially because you're going to be giving us another poem.
Sure. Let's see. Here's one. I haven't done one in rhyme yet, I think. Here's a poem in rhyme, and very appropriate to this great institution and building we're sitting in. This poem is called Library Scene. Library Scene, to P.S. Under the ceiling of metal stamped like plaster, and below the ceiling fan in the brown luster, someone is reading in the sleepy room alert, her damp cheek balanced on one palm, with knuckles loosely holding back the pages or fingers waiting lightly at their edges. Her eyes are like the eyes of someone attending to a fragile work, familiar and demanding, some work of delicate surfaces or threads. Someone is reading the way a rare child reads, a kind of changeling reading for love of reading, for love and for the course of something leading her child's intelligent soul through its inflection, a force, a kind of loving work or action. Someone is reading in a deepening room where something happens, something that will come to happen again, happening as many times as she is reading in as many rooms. What happens outside that calm like water braiding over green stones? The ones of little reading, or who never read for love, are many places. They are in the house of power. and many houses, reading as they do, doing what they do. Or it happens that they come at times to you because you are somehow someone that they need. They come to you and you tell them how you read.
It's a good poem to have read in these marble halls because people can think that this building is about columns, you know, and structure. And at the heart of it are, it's human breath that made it all start.
Yes.
And we are honoring the bicentennial of this library. It's some 2,000, almost 3,000 recorded voices, millions of books, the greatest repository in the world. And what can we say except that to hear that poem makes it all real? The rest doesn't sound real at all.
Yeah. At some point, I realized that the title, which always, I think Bob and Rita and others have felt the same, the title always is slightly embarrassing, the laureate title. It's based on the word laurel, and the crown of laurel is symbolic because laurel is a leaf that doesn't, it stays green when you pick it. It stays green, which is in turn a symbol of memory, of not forgetting. And it's appropriate for that title to be associated with this place because this is simply the greatest house of memory that has ever existed. More things are preserved in human memory here than have ever been preserved anywhere.
And what more is poetry than memory?
It's an old alliance, poetry and memory.
So let us have another poem.
Here's one I'm working on.
You are working on it.
It's a poem thinking about the year 2000 and New Year's Eve that's coming. A toast. A toast. And here's to memory that numbers all the years. Here, tipped at the arbitrary border, we living with words and cameras, dancing and champagne, toast all those others who come behind and ahead. We pray that the past and future be forgiving, the not yet born in their invisible chain, and nearly as hard for us to know, the dead. Forgive the times we haven't paid them heed, as we forgive them for thinking less of us than we might like. In our abundant time of clever machines, some of us live in need. Most of us find our gadgets mysterious. Great-grandparents, though forgetting is no crime, we try to recall you as we raise a glass. Great-grandchildren, do the same. The triple zeros that mark the millennial year are like three spheres or lights or chain links. As the centuries pass, past, present, and future, victims, villains, and heroes, each crosses the calendar border and disappears or lives in memory that numbers all the years.
I have an idea of what you could read on the McNeil Lehr Hour. It's now called the Jim Lehr.
The News Hour with Jim
News
Lehr.
Hour.
They lament on that program, they're always lamenting that hardly anybody refers to the program by its right name, which is the News Hour with Jim Lehrer.
But
I sometimes have people say to me, I saw you on McLehrer.
I definitely feel that we have one for New Year's Eve. I know you are careful not to read too many of your own poems. I know you do.
I try to space it out quite a lot.
In fact, I don't think I can remember four. I think it's been about
that's
four
about right.
this
yeah.
year.
Yeah.
And I think that one is earned, though, as will be the next one we hear from you. This is the figured wheel we're looking at.
Yeah.
And I've picked out poems that I particularly like, but what is this one we're looking at?
I'm going to read the end of, at your suggestion, Grace, I'm going to read from the poem, History of My Heart, and I'll read the concluding passage. What was it I was too young for? On moonless nights, water and sand are one shade of black, and the creamy foam rising with moaning noises charges like a spectral army in a poem toward the bluffs before it subsides dreamily to gather again. I thought of going down there to watch it a while, feeling as though it could turn me into fog or that the wind would start to speak a language and change me, as if I knocked where I saw a light burning in some certain misted window I passed, a house or store or taproom where the strangers inside would recognize me, locus of a new life, like a woods or orchard that waxed and vanished into cloud like the moon, under a spell, shrill flutes, oboes and cymbals of doom. My poor mother fell, and after the accident, loud noises and bright lights hurt her, and heights. She went downstairs backwards, sometimes with one arm on my small brother's shoulder. Over the years, she got better, but I was lost in music, the cold brazen bow of the saxophone, its weight at thumb, neck, and lip, came to a blood-warm life like Italo's flashlight in the hand. In a white jacket and pants with a satin stripe, I aspired to the roughneck elegance of my grandfather Dave. Sometimes, playing in a bar or at a high school dance, I felt my heart following after a capacious form, sexual and abstract, in the thunk, thrum, thrum, come wallow, and then a little screen of quicker notes goosing to a fifth higher, winging to clang womp of a major seventh. Listen to me, the heart says in reprise, until sometimes in the course of giving itself, it flows out of itself all the way across the air in a music piercing as the kids at the beach calling from the water. Look, look at me. To their mothers, but out of itself, into the listener, the way feeling pretty or full of erotic reverie makes the one who feels seem beautiful to the beholder witnessing the idea of the giving of desire. Nothing more wanted than the little singing notes of wanting, the heart yearning further into giving itself into the air, breath strained into song, emptying the golden bell it comes from, the pure source poured altogether out and away.
The Golden Bell. 1985. Can you believe that was 1985?
Oh, you know how to hurt, Grace.
I cannot believe that. But it just gets better and better.
You know, in the vocabulary of the saxophone, that part of the horn is called the bell. The part that opens up like a gloxinia,
right,
that flares out, that is the bell.
Right. You must have been in some place to write that poem.
Well, I think that mentioning the saxophone always inspires me because my real yearning was to make certain kinds of sounds with that horn, to do certain things with the horn. And I think I turned to poetry in frustration, realizing I wasn't going to be musician enough to get that kind of beauty out of the horn. And another poem about the horn, Ginza Samba, really are pretty overt attempts to try to create some of that feeling I wanted to make with the horn.
One thing about you is that you give credit to other people. And even if they're doing things which are in competition to you, which I always think is very nice. And one thing is you always honor your teachers. The ones you have mentioned, Fussell, was he your teacher?
Paul Fussell was my freshman English teacher, and he's a wonderful,
great teacher. Yes.
A great teacher. And author of a really great book, The Great War in Modern Memory.
One of the best books. Who would have known I'd like barbed wire so much? I mean, I couldn't stop reading that book. And his wife, Betty Fussell, just wrote an article about him and her. And I always think of you because you mention your old teachers so much. You keep them alive.
I had many good teachers and two truly great teachers in college. Paul Fussell was one of them, and Francis Ferguson was another, very important to me. And then I studied with Ivor Winters in graduate school, and it's no effort on my part to say that I'm deeply grateful to those people. Paul, this is a form of boasting to say what your favorite compliments you received are. Paul was a very elegant man. He had He had a lot of money when he was a kid. He had very beautiful manners. He dressed very well. He used all of those qualities as a teacher at the State University at Rutgers. He used them very skillfully. And one time in the Rutgers Alumni Magazine did a piece about me and interviewed Paul. And he said, I was so pleased. I felt I had achieved one of my life's ambitions. He said, and Robert has wonderful manners. Yes, I thought.
You got there.
Oh, I was happy. Funny? I was so
Aren't
pleased.
You glad you didn't chew with your mouth open when you were with him? But I was actually noticing the way you sit here. And it is very interesting how comfortable you are in a position which is beautifully mannered. It's as if I thought to myself, you know, we're not on television, but his posture is so contained. Maybe that's just from doing your thing in front of the camera. Or else maybe you have gotten good manners.
We're talking about poetry, Grace, and I like that. I'm comfortable with that subject. We're in a very good setting,
back to
and
the
you're
book.
Good to talk to.
Back to the book. There are a few we haven't read here.
Waking up. Waking up. But what woke just now at 52 years in narrow dormitory bed, clock on a chair, under pulse air conditioning, damp tangle of dream plumage, its afterbirth nimbus, night thong and mandible. Possibly for a few seconds, not more professor or poet or parent or writing conference poobah, than animal emigrant from those featherlands, the screen of boxes, the alleyway weeping, the black iceberg, the garden deception, the floating Manhattan, or naked. Possibly for a second, this vivid green moth, smaller than a numeral, distinct, animula, alert, visionless trembler, blundering in the light.
The reason I like that poem and chose it is because it would mean nothing at all if you were just an official person, and underneath that was not that vulnerability which the poem speaks about.
The poem was arose from an assignment. I'm not a great giver of assignments, but the people I was teaching at the New York State Writers Institute, a wonderful summer gathering in Saratoga Springs, New York, said they mentioned it may have been Allen Ginsberg's assignment or someone's. Anyway, we created the assignment for the group, which was write about exactly what you see in the room and around you and exactly your circumstances at some exact moment. And I don't usually do assignments with my class, but I thought I should try that one. I liked it. And it was a writing conference. I was one of the poobahs, one of the teachers. And I did wake up in the morning, and when I looked at my alarm clock, there was a very tiny green moth, smaller than the numbers on the clock. And it was sort of good morning. And that critter and I were sort of equivalent beings for a moment. We had the same we had the same degree of intention.
There's another assignment here on the opposite page.
Ah, yes, that's right. I hadn't thought of that in the layout of this book. I was teaching, well, I wasn't teaching. I was, a foundation had a program to send writers to communities that have very few writers in them. And I was in rural Illinois at a school for the blind and a school for the deaf, just going through the teaching day with a really wonderful teacher at the blind school. And the kids read their poems and we talked about them is mostly what we did. And and chatting with them, at some point it occurred to me to ask them, if you could write one great poem, if the poetry fairy told you you had one great poem in you, what subject would you want that poem to be about? And this is a poem that they're going to read on the news and that people will memorize, they'll teach it in school. What subject do you want? And blind kids, it struck me, were angry. I mean, they're adolescents, which often makes people angry anyway. And they were either blind or even worse for them in a way. Some of them were losing their sight. They could see pretty well, but they had irreversible progressive conditions. And their answers reflected, or these are the answers that four of these kids gave, and I just versified them. If you could write one great poem, what would you want it to be about? Asked of four student poets at the Illinois Schools for the Deaf and Visually Impaired. Fire, because it is quick and can destroy. Music, place where anger has its place. Romantic love, the cold or stupid, ask why. Sign that it is a language full of grace, that it is visible, invisible, dark and clear, that it is loud and noiseless and is contained inside a body and explodes in air out of a body to conquer from the mind.
In this book, The Figured Wheel, are also some translations at the end of the book. So that is a very big part of your life, and it would be nice to choose one or two of those.
I have, like many poets of my generation in this country, I have great admiration for Paul Celan. And in the course of writing a review of Michael Hamburger's quite wonderful Celan translations, I found myself doing a couple of the poems that I was writing about. If there's such a thing as degrees of untranslatability, Celan, the most untranslatable of poets, but here it is. Love Crown, Paul Celan. Love Crown. Now autumn nibbles its leaf from my hand. We are friends. We take time out of a nutshell and teach it how to go. Time turns and goes back into its shell. Now in the mirror it is Sunday. In the dream there's a place for the calm of sleep. In the mouth, the taste of truth. My eye moves down the belly of my love. We see one another. We speak the darkness to ourselves. We love one another like puppy and remembrance. We sleep like the liquor in seashells, like the ocean in the blood beams of the moon. We stand at the window embracing. They see us from the street. It is time they knew. It is time that the stone let itself break into flower, that the unresting have a heartbeat. It is time there was time. It is time.
Why so difficult to translate?
Celan's mother tongue was German, though he lived in part of Romania and spoke Yiddish and went to school in Hebrew as well as in Romanian. The language that his parents spoke best and loved best, and the language that he affianced himself to as an artist, was German. Then that was the language of the murderers of his parents and his tormentors, and it was the language of the Nazis. And he wrote German in a way that sort of explodes the language. The grammar and the neologisms, and it's as though he's writing German in a way that just punishes German and rips it apart and puts it back together in very strange ways. And it's hopeless to convey that kind of thing in another tongue.
Did you take it from the flat literal, or did you take it from broken German English?
The poems are short enough that you can pick your way through.
You puzzled it out.
The poems are short enough, and you can sit there with the dictionary and then consult. You know, look at Hamburger and look at Trotz.
So you know German.
Oh.
You know how to look it up in the dictionary.
What they call reading knowledge.
Yes, reading knowledge.
I did study it once.
Right. Oh, I thought that is impressive then, that you took it from the original.
Don't be overimpressed.
You know, you always think that the thing you can't do is the best thing in the world. And another from there. Let's have another translation. I think that is fascinating.
Well,
those are long, I know, in the back.
Incantation is a more or less a translation from a poem by my friend Czesław Miłosz.
Mm.
And I'm always thrilled by the sort of lordly way that the poem uses abstractions, and that was the challenge of making the translation. Incantation, Czesław Miłosz. Human reason is beautiful and invincible. No bars, no barbed wire, no pulping of books, no sentence of banishment can prevail against it. It establishes the universal ideas in language and guides our hand so we write truth and justice with capital letters, lie and oppression with small. It puts what should be above things as they are. It is an enemy of despair and a friend of hope. It does not know Jew from Greek or slave from master, giving us the estate of the world to manage. It saves austere and transparent phrases from the filthy discord of tortured words. It says that everything is new under the sun, opens the congealed fist of the past. Beautiful and very young are philosophia and poetry, her ally in the service of the good. As late as yesterday, nature celebrated their birth. The news was brought to the mountains by a unicorn and an echo. Their friendship will be glorious. Their time has no limit. Their enemies have delivered themselves to destruction.
Responsibility and love. Yeah. They are your names. Robert Pinsky. We will conclude, but before we go, we have to remind you that the new book is out, America's Favorite Poems, the Favorite Poem Project Anthology, and we're just going to give a little commercial about the things that are happening here. April, a symposium at the Library of Congress.
Will be devoted to the readership of American poetry. We will have people who study, historians who study literacy patterns and sales of books, and we will try to have panels with poets and scholars talking with real information and insight into a subject people sometimes natter about without knowing much, which is what did people used to read? Did they used to read more? How many copies did Leaves of Grass sell in its different editions? Did Plath's Ariel outsell it or not? And try to deal factually with the notion of readers and poets in America.
Sounds hot. This is the voice of Robert Pinsky you've been listening to, Ninth Poet Laureate of the United States. This program has been brought to you by Forest Woods Media Productions. The series is called Favorite Poets, a Library of Congress Bicentennial Project funded by the Madison Council. Our engineer was Peter Ollier. And post-production by Pam and Jim Smith of Muddy Hole Studios. I am Grace Cavalieri for The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.